How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. Thank you so much for joining us. Hope everybody's doing well, staying healthy. And in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking a lot with repeat visitor to Chatter on Books, Nevo, who's one of our favorite people. And we're going to be talking about this wonderful book. I hope it shows up nicely. Into the Riverlands. Wonderful. A small physical book with big impact and great art, by the way, on the cover. And in the meantime, we've got the award-winning Claude Jennings running things tonight.
Although you wouldn't know it by how hard it was. what award? No.
It's going to, it gets taken back after a certain point, Claude. You know? Right. David Aldridge is back, thankfully. And another repeat visitor, PJ Vernon, who was with us months and months and months and months ago with The Bathhouse, a great book, with us all the way from Calgary, where what's the temp, PJ, right now?
Well, the temp now is just 33 degrees, but nice. It's to minus 40. So we're very thankful for 33 degrees.
Oh, man. Okay. At 30, 40 degrees in Calgary, do people run around in their shirt sleeves? Is that nice, warm weather for them?
You know, they kind of, yeah. For me, I'm inside. I've got hot, drinking a hot beverage all the time, which I have to say, I'm listening to your book on audio right now. And nice. Before I signed in, I was like, I'm only a third of the way through. There's a huge moment that just was discovered. And I was like, I got a notification and it was like, I was like, oh my God, what is interrupting me? You know, this is ridiculous. And it's like, prepare for Chatter on Books. And I was like, what? Oh, the author of this book. I went and grabbed my tea, so speaking about keeping warm. And then I always like pick which animal mug I want. And I was like, this is the closest I could get to your book cover. It doesn't do it justice, but I was like,
pretty good.
I would rather drink tea and read a book than talk to me too. So I'll excuse you on that one.
And that's pretty close, PJ. I'm looking at the cover and it's kind of, in my mind, a wild boar on the front. And then it's close. Yours is the wild boar in a nice tuxedo, which is fabulous.
It's gorgeous. And okay. I can't wait to talk about it.
All right. Everybody has to humor me for just a minute or two with David, because we have not talked about this on the podcast for a couple of weeks. But here in the DMV, the District of Maryland, Virginia, probably the top news story is not the surprising results of last week's election, but the fact that the hated, much hated, my words, not David's, Dan Snyder, owner of the Washington Commanders, the local football team, is considering selling. David, what's the update? And can we be optimistic, as my children ask me every day to ask? Every day.
I'm here for the sports update. Is that correct?
Right. No, you're here for my children. The only reason my children talk to me, people, is because I know David Aldridge.
Oh, right. Well, you can be optimistic with the caveat that billionaires do whatever they want to do, and there's very little that you can do to stop them. So he may today think he's selling the team. He may change his mind tomorrow. He may find somebody to take 48% of the team, which allows him to keep controlling interest. Those things are all possible. Or it is possible that somebody offers him so much money that the NFL will step in and say, no, you're going to take that offer. We're not going to allow you to turn that down, which could happen, because, you know, it's a collection of 32 incredibly rich people who want to make even more money. And so if the asking price is $6 billion for the Commanders, as it is, most people think it would be, and someone offers him $8 or $9 or $10 billion for the team, then they will take that. The league will make him take that. Uh-huh. I think.
David, can they do that? Other owners I know have a huge amount of control, influence, whatever.
I think so, because that sets the bar for the next sale. So if one team gets a bump, a huge 25-30% bump up, because the last team that sold was the Denver Broncos, who sold for $4.5 billion earlier this year. If the next team sells for $8 billion, then everybody's floor raises, you know, even the poorest teams in the league, their teams suddenly will be worth much more money. So if it's something that's that kind of an outlier in terms of offer, then the league can say, no, this is something that helps all of us, and you're going to take it.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be so great. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that indulgence, everybody.
I'm glad I'll be quiet for the next 43 minutes.
There we go. No, you won't, because the next topic is kind of related. So one multi-billionaire that probably won't be bidding on the team because he's busy losing his money on Twitter is Elon Musk. And this is something that is near and dear to my heart, because as we were talking before the official start of this show, I am inept at most things technological. And we have this wonderful show. And the only thing I kind of really stay on top of, sort of, in terms of promoting it, is Twitter. And now I'm worried that Twitter may need to go away, or it may become a very uncool place in which to be, in which case I'll have to figure out how to do better on all those other platforms.
Mastodon.
Oh, my God. But I asked this morning, I asked a smart person this morning who should know these things. I said, is Elon Musk deliberately trying to screw up Twitter so it goes belly up and goes bankrupt and this and that? And it was explained to me that I'm an idiot. No, he spent $44 billion and he has to make this thing work. But David, then PJ, and Nee, if you want to pitch in, if you want to, we'd love to hear from you. How do you feel about Twitter these days? And have you thought about getting off Twitter?
Yes, I've thought about getting off Twitter. I don't necessarily want people to start impersonating me on Twitter, which seems like it's very easy to do now. Yeah. It's very easy to impersonate basically anyone on Twitter. So, I don't want that, because that can obviously be troubling for someone in my line of work. I don't necessarily want to see hate spewed on an hourly, daily, minute by minute basis by someone who's ripping all the guardrails from that. So, but on the other hand, you do build up a community. I've been on Twitter, I think, for 13 years, after thinking this is ridiculous. You can't say anything in 200
that long, David? Sorry.
Yeah.
Wow. And you must have been one of the originals.
Well, no, I mean, I was late, relatively speaking. Yeah. I think a lot of people got on in 06 and 07, but I've spent a long time telling people to read my stuff on Twitter, know, and everybody has that does this for a living, right? We all do it. So it's going to be difficult to find another forum that has that kind of reach and that, a lot of people that are on it and they follow you and you have a chance to have some back and forth with readers that is sometimes civil.
So. Yeah. And you can ignore the ones that aren't. Okay. PJ, you first. And then how do you feel about it? PJ, you're on Twitter, but not a lot, right?
Yeah. I have not been on Twitter. Like, I'm active, like my account, but I haven't been on Twitter since way back in the summer. I actually got sober from alcohol January 8th. So almost a year, it will surprise none of us who read and love books that a lot of the aspects of like Oliver and Nathan and all the characters in my books were things I was confronting. But part of that whole thing was, exactly like you're talking about. It was, if I can't even turn the mirror around and deal with, what's going on in here and healing myself, and rediscovering who I am, I sat there spending so much time taking on, the collective traumas of the planet every time I would get on that don't belong to me necessarily, and then not taking care of me. And so for now, I'm just like, Elon can have it. It's okay. Yeah. Anyone. I will say, though, on the other side of it, it's a tool and how you use it. And I, with conflicts in the world and just transparency and stuff like, people being able to add a dose of truth and circumvent, propaganda of governments and those sorts of things. That is a very powerful thing. But for me personally, it's just not my jam at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. Nee, how about you?
PJ covered a lot of the more global impact. So I'm going to speak on a much more personal level. I never wanted to be on Twitter and I hate it. I've always kind of hated it just a little bit, but I'm also privileged enough to say that because Tor.com has an excellent publicity department and they handle a lot of the idea of, getting my name out there and and selling the books and everything that is part of what Twitter does in publishing. But for me, my main experience with Twitter is that every time an award show rolls around, someone tries to hack my account. And I'm like, and they're not doing a very good job. They're just doing it with I have two-factor authentication and that seems to just turn them off. So I'm like, not good at it. but I'm not, I haven't had the best time on it. It's been fun, but I mean, I think I'm probably just going to crawl back to Tumblr where I belong. And if I could crawl back into the rotting corpse of LiveJournal, I would. So there we go. Okay. I'm a writer. They did not. This prepares me for a lifetime of sitting very quietly and making words. It does not prepare me for, you know, coming up with pithy things to say in under 240 characters.
Exactly.
Yes, and all three of you, because David, you have an audience and you have readers who follow you, and you want that your community. How are you going to stay in touch with them? We travel less. I mean, me and, yeah. and PJ, there are only so many bookstores you can go to and do events with 20 or 30 people sitting yeah. in folding chairs, eating cheese cubes. David, how would you prefer to stay in touch with?
I mean, if I don't know. Well, see, the problem is this, like, okay, so if you leave Twitter, oh, I could go to Instagram, which is owned by Facebook. That solves the problem. You know what I mean? Right. So I don't know is the answer. I mean, at some level, you have to accept the fact that if you're going to be on these types of forums or these types of platforms, they're going to be owned by really rich people who probably don't have your best interests at heart. So you have to either get off of social media entirely, which is kind of difficult, you know, in this day and age.
Yeah.
Or, you know, fine. Or maybe I start doing TikTok videos. I don't know. I don't know. It seems kind of silly, but
that could be a good segue to our next.
See, I did that so that you could segue to book talk. See?
David is such a pro. Okay, but I have to do this first because I swore to myself one of my fall resolutions was not to gush about Dolly Parton every week because I'm in love with Dolly Parton and I would do anything for Dolly and she's amazing. But the latest news is she won the Jeff Bezos Courage and Civility Award. Who knew there was one, which comes with $100 million that she gets to give in any philanthropic way she wants. And Bezos and his ex-wife have had this going for a couple of years now. Last year, Jose Andres, who's also just a national treasure, and Van Jones, who I kind of used to know, they each got $100 million to give any way they wanted to. So that's my gush of the week for Dolly. Okay. Segue to TikTok, David, PJ, Nee. So I'm reading the other day this Forbes article, which is talking about how TikTok, more specifically BookTok, is promoting books, especially among young people, and it is rocketing people like Colleen Hoover to the top of all the bestseller lists. And you can go through any combination of bestseller lists that you want, New York Times, USA Today, Washington Post, etc. And Colleen Hoover is up there, and there are these romance kind of adventure, kind of, you know, mystery novels kind of thing. But she's selling zillions and zillions of books, largely fueled by TikTok. And Forbes writes this article, which is primarily about how TikTok is the last, you know, next great place to sell books. And then David finds in his enterprising reporting today. Go ahead, David, from University of Pittsburgh News, by the way.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I'm not saying I agreed with the woman's position on that basically was like BookTok's terrible and we should stop doing it. You know, like they're promoting really awful books and it's just there's no diversity. It's all young white women talking about what moves them and there's no people of color. And I agree with, obviously I want there to be diversity in the workplace, but on the other hand, I think anything that gets young people to read anything is better than nothing, right?
That's what I'm like, right. So everything. So let's get her. Let's give the woman credit. Sophia. I mean, this really crucify this. Yuri Garika - Herberger, writing in the Pitt News. I'm from Pittsburgh, so I love this. Talks about how it's just BookTok is just promoting bad books and it's trash and everything else. But I'm with David. Anything that gets any young person to have a book in their hands and actually read it, I'm all for. So if Colleen Hoover is their gateway to maybe something better, God bless them. And I've actually picked up a couple of Colleen Hoover books, not too terrible. But our two authors, Nee, we'll go to you first and then PJ, you. TikTok, how do you feel about it? Have your people, and Nee, you're right, your people are really good at promoting you, promoting your books, great events, all those kinds of things. Are you on TikTok? Do you care about TikTok?
I follow like this one single TikToker who I think does old-fashioned recipes and this other one that does like, I think, DC comic skits. I'm very fond of both of them. TikTok is fun. TikTok's great. TikTok does not feel like a place for me, but honestly, Twitter didn't either. I mean, the thing is, the nice thing about being a writer who, a traditionally published writer, is I have a lot of leeway to say, you know, I'm going to ask what Alexis says, Alexis being my publicist. Uh-huh. And, or the publicist that she's not like my personal publicist, but, I think what it comes down to for me is I really do mean it when I say that my career has prepared me for putting words together. When it comes to publicity, I'm going to listen to what people who, are much smarter than I am, who have worked in the field, will tell me to do. And if they tell me to go get on TikTok, that's going to be pretty hilarious for all of us, because it's going to be like me giving like writing tips as I, you know, as I'm trying to like cook or feed my cat or play the kalimba or something like that. And they're just going to have to deal with it because they also know me and they know exactly which horse they decided to put their money on, wisely or unwisely.
Right. I would follow that. PJ, TikTok, you there? Not there?
You know, I'm not there, and I have to echo what you said, because it is a privilege to have publicity and have all of that team behind you, and it certainly wasn't always the case for me. I was there spooning out little pieces of my heart every day on social media for years. But it gets back to the whole idea of, like, is the, like, my work is the, to echo Nii, the words, right? Like, those are, that's my mm-hmm. work, putting them out there, and then understanding, do I have leftover for something else, and being very careful and using judgment. Like, hanging out with y'all feels like hanging out with old friends. Like, I had such a great time the last time I was there, and like, me, it's great to meet you, but it's being judicious about that, because, you know, even with Bathhouse, the one experience I had with TikTok was, it was brought to my attention, some, you know, trolls were complaining about this kid who was promoting, not kid, he's like a teenager, a kid to me, he's probably 25. I'm like, he's a teenager.
It's a kid.
But, you know, was promoting my book, and they were saying it was like pornography. And so they wound up having him edit it. So the cover of my book, which is just a beautiful, you know, it's a book art, was censored. And so for me, it was just like, well, it's going to be a reflection of the folks who use it. But at the end of the day, Tori, like you said, it's anything that gets people talking, reading stories, new stories for them. It is what it is, right?
Yeah. Okay. David, TikTok?
Would I do it? Oh God, I'd have to be so drunk to on the forum. But yeah. I suppose that could happen. If you pump enough ouzo into me, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
Not sober.
Yeah. My complete and total personal experience with TikTok was during the pandemic, and Mar family, five of us, wonderful girlfriend, three dogs, a lot of alcohol, in a small rural part of Virginia. And as much as I had been served, I was the only one who did not participate in the TikTok videos. And I am so glad, because it involved changing of clothes. It involved stuff in front of mirrors, which I really didn't understand. So that's been it for me. So, you know, if TikTok becomes the only way we can promote this stuff, I'm done. I'm absolutely done.
I would sit there stone-faced and just like stare at the camera for 4 or 5 minutes and see how that worked out for people.
All right, Nii, should we talk about your wonderful new book?
Absolutely.
I'm gonna sit here and hold the book up, because the cover is so fabulous, Into the Riverlands. I want to ask you about the author, but where do we find you today? How are you doing since last we met? And you know, how are you doing now? Where do we find you? What are you working on now? First,
let's see. Today you find me once again in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where it's about 32 degrees out here. So, nice. And they haven't turned on my heat yet. So I'm like huddled in this one corner of my apartment. There's a small space heater going on under my desk, and I've shoved my feet under my cat. So today's it's a bit chilly. Let's see. Professionally, Into the Riverlands came out. I'm super excited by that. I have another, excuse me. You also apparently find me just on the verge of probably picking up my first cold of the year.
There you go.
Let's see. I have another novelette coming out, I think, tomorrow with Amazon Original Stories, the Into Shadows collection, which is my work in there is What the Dead Know, which got a title change about halfway through. So I'm actually not sure if that's the title. I should check that for myself before I go much further than that. Beyond that, my big exciting news is that apparently I just found out about 6 months ago, The Chosen and the Beautiful earned out, which means that I am much more likely to be invited to come back and play this game again. So
excellent. Okay.
Super excited by that.
Explain that phrase, earned out. which is sure. what every author wants to hear.
Yes. So when a publisher buys your book, they give you an advance, a certain amount of money against the future earnings of your book. And earning out means that you have earned back that advance. And after that, you actually get to keep the royalties that are made. So that means that thanks to dual accounting, and because The Chosen and the Beautiful and Siren Queen were bought as a two-book deal, that means that it earned out for both itself and for Siren Queen. So that's super exciting.
That's great.
Very exciting.
Yes. Big congratulations.
Yes. And beyond that, let's see. I accidentally pitched a project to my agent and my editor a couple weeks ago. So sometime before January 15th, I think I have to write like another 20,000 word novella. And in the first half of 2023, I'm going to be writing a book that I don't know how to write yet. So hopefully I'll figure that out. And that's where I am.
How do you write novels, you write novellas, you write these series. Into the Riverlands is the third of a three-part series. You have these kinds of projects pop up. How do you manage your time?
Badly. let's see. Mostly I do it via word count, which I'm beginning to find out may not be the best way to do it, because 1,000 words is very nice. A bad 1,000 words is not worth the time. So trying to avoid that, which is always fun. I crash and burned a novella like about 5 months ago. So I hit like 10,000 words and I'm like, I can't use any of this. So, I mean,
I want to hear this from you. And then David, I want to hear this from you, because David, you have less of a, that's Boo saying hello. You have less of a luxury in this regard, David, but neat. When you say that 10,000, it didn't work. Do you hit delete and it goes away forever?
Oh no, it just sits on the back of my drive, shaming me for like the next 10 years.
Oh God. Okay. I get rid of emails all the time because they embarrass me so badly. And those are three words. PJ, do you write thousands of words and then throw them off into the ether?
There's a filing cabinet under my feet where there is not a cat that has whole manuscripts that the world will never see. I don't get rid of things. Like a lot of a whole point of view in Bathhouse was from a novel I broke. So I'm kind of in this habit of breaking novels every other one. Like I do one that works and then I break one. Another one. So I totally get that. Although Nia, I do not have your output at all. So I applaud you for that. And congratulations on earning out again. Cause that's like I understand very tiny percentage of titles that do that.
I love the thought of the things we'll discover, you know, 50 years from now, I'll still be alive, but we'll discover, you know, PJ's broken novels. That'll just be a great look back. Okay. David, you don't have, I mean, you often are working on deadline.
Yeah.
A little bit less so now. Your pieces tend to be more thoughtful, more reflective, more whatever. But you still do on deadline kind of stuff. You don't have the luxury of hitting delete, do you?
No. Well, I have drafts of crappy stuff that I've written that nobody will ever see. Yes, we all do. Everybody does. Not as many as actual.
Well, we will hack into your system.
But yeah, no, I mean, you know, deadline writing is deadline writing. You write it, you forget about it. You don't, I mean, you do. You just can't let it linger because it's not your best work. Everybody knows it. You know it.
You're
trying to get something out to people in a certain period of time. And you hope that they will stick around for the more thoughtful pieces that do take some time to think out and report and kind of refine and go over. I mean, I do edit. If you look at my edit marks on the longer stories, there are hundreds of them. And these are like, these are not 10, 15,000 words. These are like 2,000 words.
Right.
I will have 100 edits on it before I send it in, because I'm just,
what's the number one edit you give yourself? This is Chatter on Editing. What's the number one edit you do to yourself?
It's nothing in particular. It's just like, you'll write something and you'll go, oh, that's pretty good. And then the next morning you'll look at it and go, that is crap. What was I thinking? Like, that's really awful. It's horrendous. I got to change that immediately. And you just change it. So that's just the process of doing that until you can sort of live with yourself long enough to exist.
The only thing I can liken it to in David's world is I used to be a pretty good pool player, sign of a misspent youth. But when you play pool, you hit your shot the second you make contact, you know if it's good or not. And 2/3 of the time you go, bad, right? The thought of your finger going to the send button, David, especially, I mean, The Athletic, you have a little more control, but especially working in a place like the Washington Post, boom, once you send it to them, it's theirs.
Well, yes, but that's no different from what PJ and E do. I mean, you have editors that you trust and you think they will help your story get better if it needs to be improved, right? And that, so it's not really, it's not different in that sense, because you work with people that you, over a long period of time, realize they know what they're doing and they are going to make your story better. If they suggest something, you shouldn't be defensive and reflexive at first glance. You should listen and see what they have to say. And most of the time, they're right.
Yeah. If they're good, most of the time. Okay, Nee, give us the setting. Into the Riverlands. I have not read the first two. I have now ordered them, and I will read the first two. But one of the things I want to say before you explain to us about Into the Riverlands and these great characters is that you can read all three. I think you can read one of these. I think it stands alone beautifully. But tell us where we are, who we're dealing with in Into the Riverlands.
The setting of Into the Riverlands is basically the martial arts movies that I used to watch with my grandpa when I was about 12. So we're living in a sort of fantasy alternate universe China from somewhere in the Ming Dynasty. So, you know, 500, 600 years ago, there are magical arts that verge on magic, magic that is transformative and strange. There's a lot of queer people. There's a lot of weird happenings. There's a lot of food. And there's a lot of one non-binary cleric and their best bird friend getting into a lot of trouble.
Their best bird friend called Almost Brilliant. Can you explain why that particular kind of bird? Is it hoopoe? Is that how we say it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So Almost Brilliant, one of the main characters in the book is Almost Brilliant. It's this wonderful bird, but explain why that kind of bird, because I went and looked this up. It's a great, fabulous, fantastical looking bird.
Oh, first, they're beautiful. I've always thought that hoopoes are beautiful with their sharp little crests and their very sharp beaks and their orange and black stripes. But also it's because when I was a kid, I found this, I found half a copy of The Conference of Birds, which is a sort of mystic, I believe it is Iranian text. Yeah. And it's a series of sort of short parables that are related by hoopoe bird as it leads a bunch of birds on the search for a simurgh, which is an incredibly wise quasi-mystical bird. And it's all history and myth and weirdness. And it took me like a good decade before I had the resources to find the other half of the book, because this was like half a book I found at like a used bookstore or something like that. So it just sort of stuck with me. And that's why Almost Brilliant is hoopoe.
Okay, it's fabulous. Let's talk about the cover art before we go too much further.
Oh, yes.
Alyssa Winans, is that the right?
Alyssa Winans, yep. Mm-hmm.
That is beautiful.
Oh my God, she's fantastic, isn't she?
Yeah. Did you give her free rein the way you hope your editors give you free rein?
She's basically been with me since the beginning of the whole Seeing Hills cycle. I did not have any part in finding her. That was alltour.com. And essentially, I am not sure what happens in the mysterious meetings between her and Christine Fulzer, who's the art director over at tour.com. I do know that she gets the book. I know she reads it. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that she understands them, given how her covers turn out for me, which is this incredibly revelatory and naked feeling of seeing a book that I wrote and then having a cover that sort of just tells you what it is and her feelings and her ambitions for it. And I'm like, cool. That's my soul on a book cover. That's fine.
Nice. PJ, you have a wonderful cover to Bathhouse. How did that transpire?
Oh, John Fontana. I have no idea. He's an artist in a way that I'm not an artist. And I have to echo you, Nee. It's exactly the same. It was like, My craft was the story, putting that together, but that visualization and embodiment of it does feel like your naked soul put on a cover in a way that was almost transcendental for me, because it's nothing I would have ever expected or put on. And it's like, that's what my book looks like now. And I am so pleased to accept that. And, you know, the collaborative talents of a bunch of people coming together there's nothing like it. I got to say, there's nothing like it.
Did you love it instantly, the cover art for yours, PJ?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was floored. I was like, oh, my God. Yeah, big pink X.
Yeah, yeah.
Done.
gray, grainy. Okay, David, art of a different kind. But, you know, one of my many failed careers was being in the graphics department, the Washington Star newspaper, which no longer exists. And there was a wonderful tension often between what there were very creative people at the Washington Star at the time. There's often a great tension between the reporters who were doing the really hard work, by the way, and then the photographers and the art designers and people like that. But do you have any kind of working relationship with those people, David?
Oh, sure. When, especially for the like the longer feature stories we have. Yeah. We have graphics department. We have illustrators that really do really good work. We did a story a couple of years ago on a basketball player. And the whole premise of it was that he was kind of like almost this superhero type figure for the basketball team. It's not that he was the best player or the star player, but when he went on the floor, just these great things happened for the team. And the artist drew this illustration of him kind of almost like a DC Comics pop hero kind of thing. Wow. With the primary colors bursting out. It was just perfect for the tone of the story. So great artists can make a story sing in a way that I certainly couldn't with my stick drawings.
Yeah. Fabulous. Oh, your stick drawings again, 50 years now from now, David, they're going to be valuable. I'm going to be selling all sorts of David Aldridge merchandise. That's going to be very valuable. Okay, neat. The two main characters in the book, the ancient cleric and almost brilliant, the bird, with whom did you relate the most personally?
Between the two of them, I am very, very fond of Chi because Chi is a very bad cleric. I feel like it's sort of
I'm sorry to interrupt, doesn't want some of the responsibilities that one would normally associate with a cleric, correct?
Yes. Part of it is the fact that Chi is a wandering cleric and therefore they are far from home and they get to do things that the other people in their order might prefer that they didn't. They talk a lot about food. We haven't really gotten into it, but they like sex. They like other people. They like having a very good time that clerics typically aren't allowed to do. So they're kind of just sneaking a lot around the edges. And I love that about Chi.
That's fabulous. There are multiple stories within. This is just, I love storytelling, and that's what this book is so about, I think. And I keep saying it's physically small, but it has just these wonderful threads that spread out and spread out, and spread out. And I would find myself, there'd be one story and I go, oh, I want to know more about that. And there's another story and I'm hoping there's a sequel to this, but how did you keep them all straight? What was the writing process? Was it organic? Was it spreadsheets on the wall, which we've had authors on who've had spreadsheets on the wall?
Actually I'm a note card person. So literally all of the events on a story happen like on a note card, and I just sort of shuffle them back and forth, or I tear them up, or I create new note cards to go before or after them. And that actually works pretty well.
Wow. Okay. Note cards, index cards, handwriting.
Yep. Handwriting. And sometimes if I get too distracted, the handwriting gets really pretty and the plot goes out the window. So I have to watch that. But, yeah. It's just nice to have the tactile thing to be able to shuffle around and then to spread out on the floor as if I've actually done something productive with my day.
Yeah. PJ, how do you keep track of plot lines?
Oh, God, I don't. I break novels and then I just write another one. Cannibalize it. But I have to say I was very impressed by again, I'm only a third of the way through, but just this whole idea of like the power of stories and how they echo through cult and like inform us today and whether we choose to like make new stories or evolve them or like keep going backwards into the same, like, I just, there were so many things that just spoke to me in the first third of that book that I don't want to, I could go on and on forever, but clearly my organization of conversation is mirroring my organization of big. I just go wherever.
Okay, David, I've never even thought about this in your context, but I should. In your big, long pieces that you spend weeks and months on working, is there a, are there cards or your spreadsheet? No.
Oh, God, no. No.
Wow.
That's why I have thousands of edits. It just comes out. And the order is all messed up and stupid. And you just start working on it. And start, if I can tie one quote to one thought to one concept and just kind of go from there. But no, there's no beginning. There's no middle. There's no end.
It seems to be working. Okay.
Thoughts. Okay.
All right. Neat.
Can I ask one question?
Yes, about please.
Why I've been, well, I was researching, I was listening to your interviews, and I loved the thought. I just love the visual of you and your grandfather watching bootleg videos. It's just so awesome. I just think that's really cool. And you don't understand them and he can't really explain them to you. I just thought that was really cool. And I just wonder, like, what novellas seem to have a certain currency in certain literature. I just wonder why that spoke to you.
Well, the reason why the whole Seeing Hills cycle are novellas is because Tor.com put out a call for submissions that were unagented. I didn't have an agent at the time. And I saw that the word limit was between 20,000 and 40,000. And I said, I can write 20,000 words, which is the least amount of work I could possibly do to make something happen. And Empress, the first of the series, barely squeaks under that line. Like, I think, like, when it was going to print, Roshi Chen, who's my editor at Tor, called me and said, do you have like anything else we could put in just to fluff it out a little bit? Because we think this might be too short to bind. And I'm like, oh, shit. So I just like doing very, very little work and still getting paid for it. So that's why novellas for me.
I think that is a great approach to life.
Great approach to life. I hate work.
Little word, big pay. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's perfect. Okay. One of the many threads that runs through Into the Riverlands, which is fabulous, is this notion of the beautiful and the ugly. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, as an ugly person myself, I have a lot to say about the polemics of attractiveness, of looks, of the fact of beauty as currency, you know? And one of the fun things that I think I'm going to do in my writing from now on is the fact that throughout Into the Riverlands, the narration never calls anyone beautiful or ugly. The characters do, but when I'm describing, I think from now on, I think this is a fun trick I kind of want to play on myself and everyone else who's has to suffer through reading me. I think I kind of want to try that. I want to see what happens if I just describe the characters and then I describe other characters reacting to them. And then I see what the readers have to say, because this is actually kind of neat. Every single book I've written, all of the characters at one point or another, the female characters especially, are called beautiful. And I'm like, I never said that. I absolutely never said that.
Wow.
And that's been really enlightening, and it's been a little distressing, and it's been, you know, it led to some really interesting moments just in front of my mirror, kind of like poking at my round little face. And it's fun and it's exciting and it's weird. It's deeply, deeply weird. We're not comfortable talking about whether or not people are attractive or not, or we're too comfortable about it. And suddenly we're in this very, very dark place that is, you know, like early aughts internet, let's say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, going back to the conversation at the start of the show about Twitter and TikTok and everything else, the real or perceived emphasis on beauty is profound. It's huge. It's horrifying in terms of the impacts on a lot of people, including especially young women. It's absolutely horrifying how much it is about appearances. So I think it's fabulous that you're doing that. PJ, do you think about those things when you write about your characters?
I do, as someone who, like, as a queer man who has dealt with body dysmorphia, and, you know, my weight has yo-yoed in life depending on how, you know, the circumstances around me. Even now I'm editing my next novel, and I'm tussling, you know, back and forth between acknowledging that aspect of myself in a character who, you know, was me in high school, me in grad school, me in these phases when I was overweight, when people would really point that out to me, and then feeling guilty about, oh, well, am I going to trigger readers because they'll turn and I think I'm very attractive and I love myself and I love my body now, but, you know, being so self-conscious about how I'll be perceived, like, what does this guy know about overweight? And, you know, I've toyed with, like, do I put an author's note up front to say this is something I've dealt with in this sort of very profound way and struggled with, like, eating disorders and things like that, like, you know. And I like, me, you know, your take on it, which is like, you know what? The characters can handle it, maybe. So I came here for some writing advice. I was not joking. I'm taking notes. I'm writing 20,000 words, and the characters are going to carry the water. So thank you for that.
I love that. Okay, I had to get you out with this question for me, but I'm going to ask you of all three. And David, you're going to go first. Let's see, David. Okay, David, Nee, then PJ, alphabetical. How has your writing evolved in the last 10 years?
Oh, well, unfortunately, because of, again, the business I'm in, I currently am in, it requires you to write a lot more about what you think.
Interesting.
Not what I do. When I was at ESPN, and this was starting when I was at ESPN, I used to always say to my producers, they don't care what I think. They want to know what I know. and I really did hold on to that for a long time, for 20 years, but that's not the business in anymore.
Yeah.
I'm in. So I try very hard to self-edit my I's and me's and out of things, but it's a lot more kind of storytelling from a point of view, as opposed to kind of an omniscient narrator. It's just the way it is now.
Yeah. No, I get it. Okay, Nee, well, how's your writing evolved over the last 10 years?
So let's see. I have been a full-time writer for about 14 years now. Mm-hmm. And basically what you see today, which is the traditional published author who is writing in spec fic, that's basically just the tip of a very, very dirty iceberg. I started out writing basically advertisements for things like vacuum cleaner parts. And then I sort of graduated to ebooks where people would just send me the information about their businesses and, you know, I'd ghostwrite their ebooks about things like, you know, how to handle alpaca abscesses or how to raise cockroaches, things like that. And let's see, I have done, you know, it's basically, it's, you know, it's very much piecework. I mean, when my agent found me, I think she has this, Dana's great. She has this image, the way she says it, she's like, she heard about my early gigs and she said, "You are being exploited." Like, I can't even hit the pitch she got to when she heard about the rates I was accepting. And she's like, no, I don't care whatever happens. We're taking you from this terrible sweatshop. I'm like, it's really not a sweatshop. I have a very nice apartment. She's like, no. So, let's see. I charge more now. How about that?
There you go. That's a good evolution. That is a very positive evolution. PJ, evolution?
Yeah. I mean, it's been about learning my limits and accepting that I have to work within them. So I started out like that big giant manuscript that's sitting under it's like 200,000 words of high fantasy. When I just don't have that, that ability to ground people in the worlds that, like me, you do. So it's accepting the fact that I can tell the same story or the same feelings or evoke the same arcs. And you know what? They're not going to ride around on a dragon. They're going to drive in a Honda because I can just say Honda and people will know. And I just have to accept that and hopefully get paid more too, because artists should get paid.
Oh my God, that's spectacular. You should get paid a lot just for that line.
Honda and dragon, right?
You should get paid a lot for that. That is fabulous. This has been a great conversation. Okay, this particular book is Into the Riverlands. Nee, it's wonderful. So appreciate that you wrote it and you put so much heart into it. It's fabulous. And I'm really bad at words. I really should not have a podcast about books because I'm terrible at words. But I keep looking at the physical essence of it, and it's small and it's beautiful and it's discreet, but it has just huge impacts. So I really hope lots of people go out and buy that.
Hey, Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
Okay, this has been one of my favorite conversations ever, ever, ever. Claude, thank you for making it happen, my friend. You know, a little hitchy at first, but thank you for making it happen.
Eventually.
David, good to see you, my friend. I'm going to be thinking about you this week. PJ, so great to see you again from Calgary. Come back as long as the weather stays, you know, decent. Nee, congratulations. It's fabulous. Really, really fabulous. Wish you the best of luck and hope you will come back as well. And everybody come back next week. Next week will be our Thanksgiving show. We have Nevin Martell, man of all talents, including great food. Rodney Ferguson, who's going to be our celebrity mixologist for the show. And this great guy, Bob Brush. If this is probably David, you and I might be the only ones who remember the Wonder Years. One of the most successful TV shows, whatever. Yeah, this great guy, Bob Brush, created the Wonder Years, and now he's got this fabulous book called The Piazza, which, talk about illustrations, has some fabulous illustrations by a guy named Scott Howard. But he will be with us. Hope you'll join us. In the meantime, thank you, and everybody stay well, and we're out.